Come fly with me. Let's fly away.
Welcome to Travel with Stephanie Abrams.
This hour, we're continuing our conversation with Mark Leslie. If you've missed anything, any part of today's show, please go to travelers411.com. And within about 72 hours of this broadcast, you will find under podcast the capability to download hours 1, 2, and 3 of this show independently from one another. Also, go to sabrams.com, and in the show notes, there's a place to click, and you can hear the archived audio. Podcasting you can download for 52 weeks. The audio is there forever. Let's go off and talk with Mark Leslie right after this.
Portions of today's show brought to you by Incredible Malta, where seascapes, landscapes, great food, beach and city resorts, incredible history and architecture, and wonderful inhabitants make Malta a must-visit destination. For details, go to visitmalta.com.
Well, we are carrying on this hour with Mark Leslie, the CEO, Managing Director, Head Honcho of Martello Media, located in Dunleary. That's spelled nothing like what it sounds. In fact, if you look at the way it's spelled, it kind of looks like Dungle Harry. And I am so happy to have him on the line, and we have our rebuttal team here, headed up by my production assistant, Erin Go Wolf, our Springer Spaniel. She is liver and white. She is gorgeous. And if you go online, you will find pictures of her, both in my Facebook, and I'm pretty sure we have, well, if I haven't written something about her in my blog, I really should. She is the world's best doggy traveler. Loves to go bye-byes, my goodness. Take out her leash, and she's at the front door waiting to go. Take me. I want to go bye-byes. Something like I was, I think I said bye-bye before I said mama. But it's wonderful to have Mark on the line with us because this, you know, travel and tourism is greatly affected and impacted by economics, politics, natural disasters, weather conditions, you name it. Somebody sneezes at one end of the world and somebody on the other end of the world decides they can't go there because they're going to catch a cold. So Mark and I had a conversation yesterday, and I implored him, even though he has the most ridiculous pressing schedule, he has been kind enough and generous with his time to put those items aside, to share some of the things we talked about yesterday, because they really are important. And one of the things we were talking about is this business of Brexit, which, while the politicians banter it around, are having very real and serious effects on everything from the visitor, the traveler, the business person on a business trip, the shopkeeper, the farmer, the hotelier, and all of those that are involved in the travel industry as it relates to travel to the UK, and how that is going to affect the traveler visiting Ireland, who for the last, as my good friend Derek Warfield, from founder of the Wolf Tones and the Young Wolf Tones, would have said, there hasn't been a border in Ireland in 10,000 years except for a line, an imaginary line, drawn in the earth, a real dotted line drawn on a map that tells you when you're here, you're in the Republic of Ireland, and when you're there, you're in Northern Ireland. And the only way the traveler to date has known the difference is that when you cross from the Republic into the North, the mileage, the distance to the next town is shown in miles instead of kilometers on road signs. And when you pass a petrol station, a gasoline station, the cost will be shown in pounds sterling and not in euros. And I will say one other thing. The roads in Northern Ireland tend to be a little better maintained. Other than that, you really don't know the difference. It's like crossing from Delaware into Maryland or New Jersey into New York. You just, you know, there's a welcome sign. Hey, y'all, welcome aboard. Glad you're here. But that could change with Brexit. And there might be the kind of border where you have to stop and present a passport and have a conversation about where you've been and where you're going and why you're doing it. And let me search your trunk or your boot, as they would be asking in a on the other side of the ocean in English. The boot of the car is the trunk. And so I wanted to talk with you a bit, Mark, about, you know, your thoughts on this whole Brexit business. And I knew that disaster was impending when Theresa May started aligning herself with the DUP party, because they're a little off the wall.
Yes, put it mildly.
So what are you seeing? And I particularly want you to take, we're going to start with what are you seeing now, and then we're probably going to have to take a break, and I want to talk about your impending trip in June to Spain and what you're foreseeing in that. But let's start with what you're seeing now in Ireland and the impact of the impending Brexit on life in general.
Well, there's huge sort of apprehension because I was talking earlier on about the problems the Northern Irish are going to have getting their agricultural goods to market in the UK. But we have a similar problem writ large in that the Republic of Ireland import a vast amount of stuff to mainland Europe. And we use Great Britain as being a land bridge. We whiz over on fast ferries to Holyhead and Liverpool. We're not stopped. Our goods have the perfect right to cross the entire United Kingdom and exit the port of Dover and Folkestone and arrive in Calais. And it's all toll-free, tariff-free, paperwork-free. So again, Irish agricultural fresh lobsters and mussels, you know, are on the tables in Paris that evening that were pulled out of the sea in Dublin Bay early in the morning. And suddenly, the island of Great Britain, from being a handy land bridge, which makes this much quicker than going by boat, you know, to the continent, is now going to be in the way. It's going to be like a giant version of the Titanic iceberg. It's going to be uncrossable. And even now, Ireland is investing in having to buy giant freezer ships and ferries and invest in tarmac space, you know, in Boulogne or whatever, so that it can be checked to make sure it hasn't come from Britain. So it's already costing us hundreds of millions before Brexit has even happened. But most distressingly, the entire argument about the desirability of Brexit, which is in the UK is done in terms of economics, seem to be missing the entire point of what the EU was, which was to guarantee democracy and peace between the four most dangerous nations on earth, and of course, the greatest respect, more, you know, higher casualties in the disastrous wars between Britain and France, and France and Germany and everyone else. And, you know, my 11 generations of my family have had to fight and die, had to leave Ireland to fight and die or be maimed in land wars on mainland Europe. And my beloved Uncle Jack, God rest his soul, who died 2 years ago, who did fought in the disastrous Dunkirk campaign and was imprisoned for 5 years in Nazi camps in Germany, said it was all worth it because it led to a united Europe, and that he could walk from the north of Scotland to the south of Greece and say, this all belongs to me, this all belongs to all of us. We, the people of Europe, have shed enough blood in enough wars to deserve peace being cemented by becoming one economy, one sort of neo-federation of states that are allowed to keep their culture and their customs and all that's special about them, but freely travel, work, retire. You know, hundreds of thousands of British retired happily in Spain, and now suddenly the rug is being pulled under all of this before we've completed the project of building a border-free Europe, before we've managed to incorporate the Balkans, which are the notorious powder keg of Europe. You know, I'm doing missionary work, working on museums in Serbia, where they're slowly coming to terms with their bloodthirst-soaked history, which, unlike our bloody history, sort of ended 60 years ago, 70 years ago. To them, it's only 20 years ago. And the tectonic plates, you know, the work of building Europe is being completely undermined if you whip, you know, the tablecloth from under the crockery, and the British are doing it in a very tack-handed way. They're not whipping it fast enough to leave the crockery on the table. They're pulling everything on the, potentially pulling everything on the table onto the floor in a horrible mess.
We're going to pick that thought up.
The rise.
Well, we're going to take a quick commercial break and come back talking with Mark Leslie, particularly about the effects on travelers as it relates to the story about Brexit. It's not just an economic story. It's a story that is going to have enormous impact on travelers and tourism and products and services available when you're traveling in Europe as a result of this Brexit story. So we're going to do that after these important messages. Don't leave me. This is Stephanie Abrams.
This weather report is brought to you by the Curaçao Tourism Board. The long-range weather forecast for the north coast-to-coast calls for snow, sleet, icy rain, slippery roads, and a wind chill factor well below freezing. The long-range forecast for Curaçao calls for warm and sunny today, warm and sunny tomorrow, next month, and the months that follow, with highs around 86 degrees and lows around 76. Isn't it time to plan your breakaway in Curaçao now? Learn more at Curaçao.com. That's Curaçao.com.
Time for more travel talk. It's Travel with Stephanie Abrams.
I have on the line Mark Leslie, live from County Dublin, Ireland. If you've missed any part of today's show, please remember that you can go to travelers411.com and you can find the podcasts, which generally become available for download about 2 to 3 days after the broadcast, and they are available for 52 weeks. Simultaneously, we archive every show. You go to sabrams.com, and you'll find the on-air quick links box in the sidebar in the right column, and you can go in there and click on archived shows and listen to them forever and ever. So while you can't download them, they'll always be available. And if you're interested in downloading and taking us with you, we're happy to join you in your travels, and you can do that for every broadcast for 52 weeks. I also want to remind you that Travel with Stephanie Abrams is broadcast and available to subscribers to iHeartRadio. And interestingly, I went there today. I actually went to Google, and I put in iHeartRadio Biz, B-I-Z, Talk Radio Network. And what came up first, and I'm going to put a link in my blog to make it easy for you, is a link that took me directly to the Biz TV channel at or station at iHeartRadio.com. And there's a button, you know, a little diamond-shaped play button that you can click and hear whatever is on right now. So wherever you are in the world, if you want to hear us live, go to iHeartRadio to the Biz Talk Radio channel between 6 and 9 p.m. Eastern Time, no matter what time zone you're in. So for you, Mark Leslie, if you want to listen to us on iHeartRadio, that would be 11 p.m. Sunday evenings, because it'll be 6 p.m. East Coast time. And if you're out in California, we start at 3 in the afternoon. And if you're in Hawaii, we start at noon. Depending on the time of year, because they don't change their clocks. So sometimes there's a 5-hour time difference and sometimes there's a 6-hour time difference. But anywhere you are in the world, you can get us on iHeartRadio Live when it's 6 p.m. in New York Sunday night on the Biz Talk Radio Network. And make sure you check out my TV show, Travel TV with Stephanie Abrams, on the Biz TV channel. You can get it in over 30 million households in the U.S. And Hawaii, even though we know you're U.S., but you're not mainland. So the mainland and Hawaii. And you can also get it if you have Roku. Sunday nights when it's 5 p.m. in New York City, figure out what time it is where you are. And you can watch us on TV, so that's great. And you'll find it also archived at biztv.com. So lots of opportunities for you there. We were talking about the mishmash that this Brexit is creating for the people who live on the island that is Ireland. And you were telling me a story. Well, there are a couple of them you told me yesterday. So why don't we talk about what's happening economically in England with the Japanese car companies that invested billions of dollars building manufacturing plants and now have a problem. Maybe you can explain that problem.
Yes. Well, when the British motor industry sort of collapsed back in the 70s and 80s, the Japanese saw an opportunity. And whereas the British had struggled to sell their cars effectively outside of the UK and into Europe, the Japanese, because of their just-in-time policy, you know, their very efficient industries, took over a lot of the main British car plants, particularly Nissan and Honda, and then on the understanding that they would acquire at least 20% of the components, specialist components, from the traditional British suppliers initially, and then when Britain joined the EU across Europe. So basically, all of the Japanese cars in Europe, or a huge percentage of them, were made in the UK from car parts supplied from all over Europe, including Britain, assembled in Britain. The parts would be imported into Britain, assembled, and then exported as whole cars back into France, Germany, wherever. And this suited the British very well because it preserved a lot of the skilled smaller companies that made the components without giving the British the headache of having to sort of sell the cars and somehow cover the costs of exporting efficiently. And this has been a very major part of the economy of a lot of the more depressed areas of the UK, such as South Wales and Sunderland in the north. By some mad quirk of fate, the people in these underdeveloped areas somehow felt they were getting a bad deal with Brexit, forgetting that most of their jobs came from Japan. They forgot the European dimension. They said, oh, we don't need to be in Europe. We get all this wonderful work from Japan, you know, not realizing that the only reason the Japanese had set up in these places was, of course, access to the European made components and engines from Germany and instant, painless, paper-free, direct access of the finished cars straight back into Europe because of the single market. So the Japanese, having just announced a couple of years back that a whole new line of cars that were going to be specifically made in Britain, they were about to invest in further expanding their giant car plants, have just last month announced they're pulling out entirely and moving their plants lock, stock and barrel, surprise, surprise, to the European mainland so as to be able to maintain the access to all of their existing component suppliers, you know, 80% of the key chain, similar to the situation on the U.S. border with Mexico, you know, where components made in the U.S. get imported by Mexico, assembled into cars, repushed back into the United States to be sold. Complex network, globalized networks that the European Union had facilitated and will continue to benefit from. So effectively, Britain has pulled the plug on what's left of its major manufacturing areas, where nearly everything is either Japanese, US, or European-owned. And quite apart from car parts, you know, I have the misfortune to have been born in a smog in London in 1952. I happen to hold a UK passport.
I want you to hold that thought right there.
I could vote here. I could do what I liked. But I'm now faced with five-hour queues on my next trip to continental Europe.
I want you to hold that thought right there because we're going to take a quick break and come back. I was curious about that whole story about your trip to Spain and why it was going to be a difficult story for you. We're going to take care of that in the next segment. So stay with me, everybody. This is Stephanie Abrams. Don't leave me.
Portions of today's show brought to you by Incredible Malta, where seascapes, landscapes, great food, beach and city resorts, incredible history and architecture, and wonderful inhabitants make Malta a must-visit destination. For details, go to visitmalta.com.
Be the pizza, Mr. Cowan, early in the morning. Hook a leg of paddy dear, I'm over here. Hook a leg of paddy dear, it's linked to stop your yawning.
Some say the diddle is dead, the diddle is dead, the diddle is dead. Some say the diddle is dead and buried in Killarney. More say he rose again.
buckle your seatbelt and tune in to Travel TV with Stephanie Abrams, airing coast to coast weekly on Sundays in the 5 p.m. Eastern time slot. For a list of cities and stations where Travel TV with Stephanie Abrams will air, visit Stephanie's blog at sabrams.com/blog and biztv.com. If you're traveling, check local listings in cities including New York, Boston, Miami, Atlanta, Tampa, Orlando, Houston, Dallas, Las Vegas, Nashville, Los Angeles, and more.
Time for more Travel Talk. It's Travel with Stephanie Abrams.
On the line with me is Mark Leslie, the Managing Director, CEO, Chief Man in Charge of Martello Media, based in Dunleary in County Dublin, on a hop and a jump from Dublin Town, and right by the sea. He's really located himself in such a prime, lovely spot. The sea, where every morning, 365 days of the year, or of the days that he's not traveling of the year, you will find him in the morning swimming in that cold water. Do you still do that?
Yes, I was in the sea this morning. It was absolutely wonderful. We're having, thanks to global warming, we're having June weather here in February. Bright, bright summer sunshine and wonderful sunrises and warm sea. So we're sort of enjoying it while we can, but the long-term consequences of this weird climate change, can't be good.
No, it's not good. You know, it's funny that you talk about the sunshine. I just read something yesterday I found really disturbing. If you look, we must have, 20 or 30,000 photos just of Ireland at sabrams.com and travelers411.com. And if we've now produced and broadcast 19, we're about to broadcast the 20th episode of Travel TV with Stephanie Abrams, of which almost half of those episodes deal with Ireland and places in Ireland. When you look at the video, you may see some scenes with gray skies, but, you know, we don't live in Ireland. We go over for X number of weeks a year, and we are privy to whatever the weather is that's being delivered to us. And yet you will see, both in the still photos and in the videos, amazingly gorgeous sunny days, so bright that my eyeglasses, which self-tint to become sunglasses, are so dark, and I'm still squinting. And yet the Irish seem to luxuriate in promoting what I see as the great myth that it downpours every day, and if you take a trip there, you're just going to get drenched. And a lot of people don't travel to Ireland because they've heard the stories about the rain. And then just yesterday or the day before, I was reading some story about some new postage stamps that are being made. And they were some chosen design in some kind of a contest. And it glorifies rain in Ireland. It's all the postage stamps are all about the rain. And it's like, are you people crazy? I mean, are you just mad? Where is the disconnect that the people who live in Ireland, and even the people in tourism, I interview people, and we get to the end of a gorgeous interview, and they say, well, you know, as long as it doesn't rain. And I was just talking to somebody yesterday who came back and said, we were in Ireland for 3.5 weeks. We had just glorious weather. Yeah, there's the occasional rain, but often it's a mist, or it rains from 1 to 3 and then it's done. I don't.
Absolutely. It's in any good typical Irish day, I say, pack your galoshes, umbrella, and your sun cream, because you'll need them all. You know, we have about 4 seasons a day, I would say. The sun is always shining the first half an hour after dawn in the spring.
Usually till 11. Until the sun gets above the clouds.
The heat creates the clouds.
Right.
So I have a sunny swim about 95%. I swim 360, you know, days a year, and I get sunshine. If I swim just after dawn, it's a sunny day. So even if the rest of the day is snowing or lashing, I've had my hour of sunshine. Wisdom on Dublin Bay is if you could look across the bay and you see the beautiful Howth Head on the other 5 miles on the other side, picked out in lovely yellow sunbeams, that's actually a warning sign that it's just about to rain. And if you can't see Howth Head picked out in sunbeams, you know it is raining.
Yeah, but somebody taught me long ago that, you know, when you wake up in the morning, no matter what time it is, and I'm up early in Ireland because I'm still functioning on U.S. time. So that time difference works in my favor when I get to Ireland. But you'll see clouds up in the heavens. And somewhere around 11 o'clock in the morning, the sun gets to the point where it goes up above the clouds, and then it becomes a gray day. So until then, the mornings are always very sunny. And then from that point on, you don't know if, you know, it just may be a gray day and just never rain. But by the way,
sometimes the sun will reappear below the clouds as it sets at about 6 in the evening, and you get a glorious, particularly on the west coast of Ireland, you know, Galway Bay, there's songs about, you know, that wonderful evening light, which George Bernard Shaw described, the golden fairy light of an Irish evening, where he said the Englishman will never understand, they have no such yearning, you know, in their daylight that there is in Ireland, where you get that feeling that fairyland is just around the corner.
Well, and the interesting thing,
too, very magical light, the Celtic twilight. So you're right, before 11 and in the evening, you get the same effect. The morning effect in reverse very often,
and the interesting thing about that is that when you get into springtime, by the time we roll into May, you have daylight until about 11 o'clock at night. You start to have at 10:30 at night, you'll have the kind of light we have at 4:30 in the afternoon. And I have sat in our car without benefit of the overhead light bulb in the car, reading something as we were driving on our way to somewhere. It gives you the most incredibly long sightseeing and day of play. And for people who like to golf, you can do all your sightseeing, all your shopping, all your swimming and luxuriating, have your dinner, and at 8 o'clock go out on the golf course and play a full 18 holes and stand there at 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night without benefit of artificial lighting and add your score up. I mean, it's incredible. And it never really gets dark, dark, dark the way it does in winter. And somewhere around 3:30 in the morning, those miserable roosters are going to start waking you up because the sun's coming up. So you have a very short night and a very long day, and it makes for great fun and play. You know, you told me yesterday about your plans for a trip to Spain in June, and you were concerned about the arrival. And I'm going to have you tell the story in the next segment because it's a lengthy story, but it's a good one that we have to discuss. And what was interesting to me about that was that you talked about going to Spain and that the Europeans have plans to have their own kind of prejudicial revenge on all people traveling with a British passport. And you expected that was going to happen to you. And after we hung up, I thought, why do you have a British passport? And you alluded to that in the last segment. So we've got just about a minute, and I mean literally 60 seconds. Can you explain why my friend the Irishman has a British passport?
Well, my father served in London in the war as a fighter pilot, where he had the good fortune to meet a penniless European refugee and marry her. So for the first few years of their married life was in London. And I was born in the great smog of 1952.
Oh, my God.
They couldn't get me to hospital in time.
You're lucky you didn't die.
I have... Unlike my children, my parents, my brothers, my sisters, I'm the sort of embedded Brit in the family that I have this British passport.
Okay. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about two things. One is, I think most Americans are not aware of the great smog of 52 that killed so many, and you are lucky that you as an infant were not among the fatalities. And I want you to explain the relationship between the British smog that killed so many, where this smog rolled in to London and literally just killed people. And where it came from and its relationship to the coal industry of the UK, which was such a vital part of the economy at that time. So we're going to take a quick break and come right back. We're talking with Mark Leslie, and we've got to talk about the Great Smog of 52, its relationship to today and the coal industry, and to the difficulty of people with UK passports traveling in Europe if this Brexit thing goes through. We'll be right back. Don't leave me.
Time for more Travel Talk. It's Travel with Stephanie Abrams.
A relative of the Leslie family of County Monaghan, Ireland, in a town called Glasslough, where you'll find Castle Leslie, which means Green Lake. But a relative was the Duke of Wellington, and I believe his saddle and bridle can be found in the Equestrian Center at Castle Leslie. And he was born in what is now the Merrion Hotel in Dublin. And someone is said to have asked him or commented to the Duke of Wellington, "Well, you know, you were born in Dublin, so I guess that would make you an Irishman," to which he is said to have answered, "By that logic, sir, were I born in a stable, that would make me a horse," because he very much saw himself as a Brit. Now, my good friend Mark Leslie, who is on the line with us from Dublin, whose first cousin once removed was Winston Churchill, whose family is very much Irish, carries a British passport, because, as I've just learned, he was born in London during the Great Smog of 52. And that's not 1852, by the way. He's not that old. That would be 1952. And if you see, I'm pretty sure there are a couple of Churchill films out right now, but I think it was the film Darkest Hour, in which they dealt with the smog of 52. And whether it's in it or not, you should see it. But I have to tell you something funny about that film. When I was watching it, there were a few things that happened and a few references made in that film that I knew the backstories on because of you, Mark. So give us, for my audience's benefit, an understanding of the smog of 52 and its relationship to the production of coal and use of coal.
Well, there were smogs right through to 1956 and 7. I remember as a three-year-old, London completely grinding to a halt. Just no traffic, and you had to feel your way along the pavements. I remember going to my primary school with three scars wrapped around my face and a black, sooty circle where I'd been sucking the air in through my scarves. Before they wisely the next day decided to cancel school. But the worst one ever was 52, was the one I was born in, where thousands died. And literally, the whole of Britain ran off coal then. You heated your house with coal fires, the electrical power stations were generated with coal. And as long as the wind kept blowing, it was grand. It swept the smoke sort of out to sea, as they thought. But a huge temperature inversion stopped the hot coal smoked air up, held it all down, and because it was cold and damp and miserable out of season, everybody lit coal fires, you know, to against the fog. So a miserable wet fog and a temperature inversion combined with the coal smoke to create this sooty, wet, black smog. And it literally ultimately led, I think, to the demise of the coal industry, because the medical authorities in Britain said this has killed. It was a state secret just how many thousands of people had died as a result. But in a small matter of days, I think it ran to many tens of thousands. And you're right, it's dramatically treated in the TV series The Queen, The Crown.
Ah, that's where I saw it.
In the first series. I think there's a whole episode devoted to the smog.
Yes, and you see the Queen, you know, in Buckingham Palace, nobody's going out. You know,
yes,
the shutters are drawn.
So it reached to the top. Up until then, coal smoke had largely been in the grimy industrial cities of the north, you know, driving the mills. But when it came to London to that degree, suddenly people sat up and said, we've got to take some action about this. So it ultimately led to the running down of the coal industry. So if any politician in America tells you you need to go forward with coal, you, by all means, I'm sure you have lots of coal, but it will be at a terrible price because, you know, with unpredictable weather and temperature inversions, sooner or later you're going to get the smogs that, you know, killed so many tens of thousands in London when I was growing up.
Well, you know, and it's fascinating to hear people banter around the term clean coal. If you want to know, if you're in an English class trying to understand what an oxymoron is,
that's it.
Clean coal. It's two words that do not work together like jumbo shrimp.
I'm delighted to say, as a collateral descendant of the Duke of Wellington, he never actually said that. He was quite proud of being Irish. It was Daniel O'Connell who said it. Because basically, Daniel O'Connell was a bitter adversary of the Duke of Wellington during his great reform movement to get a vote for Catholics, which the Duke, as Prime Minister, was a bit iffy about. And he said, but surely, Mr. O'Connell, with an Irish Prime Minister, things will go your way. And he said about the Duke of Wellington, oh, just because you're born in a stable doesn't mean you're a horse. But he said it in a phrase, you know, not in a purgative way, because a horse, in Ireland, conjures up a racehorse, you see, in a thoroughbred. But the English have mistakenly never ceased misquoting and attributing it to the Duke of Wellington giving a witty put-down to O'Connell. But the true story was O'Connell giving a witty put-down to the poor Duke of Wellington.
You know, there's a reason that I love you, fella. One day, I'm going to take a month, and I'm going to come to Ireland, and I am going to dog shadow you for every leisure moment you have or can make so that we can do a book about all the things you know and other people don't, and that you could so concisely put together.
Slightly wrong.
Well, and also to include the stories of your famous or infamous aunt who was a spy. We're coming to the end of this hour. I want to take you into the first segment of the next hour just so you can share with us the story about what's going to happen for travelers carrying a British passport in Europe that has been already bantered about. And none of this stuff do we hear in the U.S. Not any
of it.
Well,
I can tell you in a
nutshell. No, you can't tell me anything.
Hang
on. We've got to take a break right now because the network will cut us off in a syllable. So stay with me, everybody. Stephanie Abrams here. We're flying high.
Get you up there. I'll be holding you so near. You may hear angels cheer. 'Cause we're together, weather-wise, it's such a lovely day. You just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. It's perfect for a flying honeymoon, they say. Come fly with me, let's fly, let's fly. Pack up, let's fly away.